Thank you, Mrs. Tina. Wait here a minute. I guess Mr. Black will get the volume adjusted a little bit. So we can do this together. I was accused in Orlando, spoke down there a month or two ago, and I was speaking. I thought I was speaking quite loud, but it was such a big room. I couldn't really get the concept of how the volume was getting all the way to the back of the room. And it was something like a hall that we might have had the Feast of Tabernacles in at Mount Pocono or something like that. So I felt, and there were people quite a ways back. I felt I really need to have some volume. And afterwards, I was told that I shouted them all down. So there's adjustment necessary on the volume. And Mr. Black has given me this lapel mic because I also have been told that I go fade in and out by moving back and forth from the microphone, and so it's not good, especially when we're making recordings. So thank you, Mr. Black. I'd like to say that the special music by the children was really special. And I really appreciate Mrs. Hills doing all of the work in a very short time to be able to put this kind of presentation together. And we do have special children. Really, not only do we have a lot of children, which is rather unusual in this day and age, but we have a lot of children that are very special. And so we have really good ones. So thank you all. Thank you, performers, you children who performed. Thank you very much for everything that you did. As well, I would like to, here at the start of this message, thank everybody who did so much to be able to make this whole festival, not only today, but the first day, and especially today with all of the things where we had double services and a meal between. And everyone who did so much, you know, just think of all of the people who contributed so much, ladies, for all of the food that you worked on and prepared, Mark and the boys who did all of the setup. I understand that's correct, Mark. You and the boys did all of the setup. Andy also. Okay. Those people who transported equipment and who will be doing cleanup, did cleanup last week, will be doing cleanup this week, speakers, song leaders. I'm just kind of speaking off of the top of my head without really organizing everything, but there was a lot of effort that went in, and we're a fairly small group, and a lot of people have to do things for us to be able to have the kind of service that we have. And it is, I think, you know, in accordance with our overall objective of encouragement, peace, joy, all of those things I think went together to be able to produce that attitude among ourselves during this festival. So thank you all for all that you did in that regard. I just wanted to brush quickly over a scripture and a little bit of explanation that we typically go into here on the holy days, not only the days of unleavened bread, but all of the holy days. We are here today because God commands it. I think one of the messages we talked about keeping. I think Mr. Rigord was talking about keeping, walking, keeping. And performing, walking, keeping, and performing. We are keeping this festival because God has ordained it. Now, we can't keep something that God hasn't ordained. And so we're here keeping it. Leviticus 23 and verse 6. On the 15th day of the seventh month is a feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. There's an overview to these days of unleavened bread. Starts with the Passover, because until the Passover was fulfilled and Christ was sacrificed, it was not possible to have what follows. What follows the Passover is this festival, which taken together, the 7 days of unleavened bread, picture repentance, and the seventh day, today, pictures baptism. And so we saw quite a lot of explanation by Mr. Buchholz in his sermon regarding that. So taken together, these days picture repentance and baptism. And in particular today, the day that the Red Sea was crossed, it's the anniversary of the crossing of the Red Sea, pictures baptism. Sermon that I am giving today concerns a very prominent theme in the Bible, particularly in the Gospels, but it's also relevant throughout the rest of the Bible as well. I had decided some time ago in advance of this particular message that I would give the message on this particular subject. The subject is the leaven of the Pharisees. Leaven of the Pharisees. And I was pretty sure I knew where I was going with it. I thought I knew where I was going with it. I've heard sermons on the leaven of the Pharisees before, and I thought it'd be something very similar. But in regard to this, I started to study some things in the Bible myself, and I discovered certain things that I did not expect in regard to the leaven of the Pharisees. And there was a theme, a connecting theme that went together in these scriptures that have to do with the leaven of the Pharisees. So in studying those scriptures, you know, looking up this phrase, the leaven of the Pharisees, I find, well, first of all, just taking the word leaven itself. Now, I had the concept that it was far more predominant in the New Testament than it actually is. Granted, the theme of leavening and the days of unleavened bread is far more pervasive than just the word leaven. You know, as many times it's referred to in different ways, sin and so forth, which we know the days of unleavened bread picture the getting of sin out of our lives. But looking at the word leaven itself, it occurs in the New Testament 13 times. 13 times. That's all the number of times that you find. It's rather surprising to me, really, as important as the theme of leavening is in the New Testament, to find that that word only occurred 13 times. Of the 13, four of them were outside the Gospels. Three in 1 Corinthians, you know, 1 Corinthians 5, it's used three times there in those verses where it says, we always quote the scripture that says, the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, and put out the leaven of malice and wickedness, and keep the feast with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Well, in that context, there are three of the occurrences, and it occurs one time as well in the book of Galatians. We'll use that scripture toward the end of the sermon. After you take those four out, then there are nine occurrences of the word leaven left in the New Testament. All, as I say, in the gospel. Interestingly enough, all nine times, the word leaven is used. It's used by Christ. Always used by Christ. Two of those times are in a parable. Once in Matthew and once in Luke. the parable of the woman who hid leaven in three measures of meal. So that boils it down to seven occurrences left in the Gospels where the word leaven is mentioned. The other seven occurrences in the Gospels, all mentioned by Christ, all refer to the leaven of the Pharisees. It gets to be like it's been repeated by Christ a few times there in the New Testament and the Gospels. And there is quite a lot of information there about the Pharisees and how they lived and what was wrong with their approach. Leaven of the Pharisees. What I want to do today is to examine the leaven of the Pharisees. I said that I found a rather different... I thought I knew where I was going to go with this sermon. But as I studied each one of these scriptures, started taking me in a direction that I wasn't exactly expecting to go. So I sort of worried about this, or had a little bit of, difficulty in assimilating what I was finding to be there in the study of these scriptures. I expected, in giving this sermon, that what I would be primarily focusing on is you and I putting the leaven out of our lives during the days of unleavened bread, and the leaven we were to put out of our lives being the leaven of the Pharisees. And I don't say that isn't a theme that you find in the phrase, the leaven of the Pharisees, or in the discussion that Christ made. But rather than, as you read these seven times that he talks about the leaven of the Pharisees, rather than it being directed toward his disciples and saying, this is something you need to take out in your lives. Now, I think we would all take that admonition as being implicit, but he is warning his disciples, not instructing them so much as he is warning them to be aware, to watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees. Luke 12, you find some of that. Luke 12, verses 1 and 2. In the meantime, when there were gathered together an innumerable multitude of people, insomuch that they trode upon one another, he began to say unto his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. There is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, neither is anything hid that shall be known. And when he says, warning, watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees, he says, beware. That's a warning, isn't it? Beware of it. You can beware of it in yourself, and we should beware of it in ourselves. But it seems like he's pointing this warning at something that can approach you even from outside. Beware of it in both regards, inside yourself as well as out. But this is directed at beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. You get a kind of a warning. I thought, this occurs virtually every time that he talks about the leaven of the Pharisees. He says, watch out for for those Pharisees. Watch out for them, and watch out for the leaven which they have. I thought about, you know, warnings. This is a warning, and warnings that we have, different concepts about in our own lives. I thought about, railroad crossings. If you're coming to a railroad crossing, oftentimes you see these arms that cross each other, which have lights on them, and they will have also jangling bells. Ding, 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 ding. You know, there's a train coming, and you need to pay attention to that. Beware, watch out for, that this could be a problem. My father was in the railway mail service, and he rode the trains, it was his job. He rode on the trains, and he would go from Atlanta to Salisbury, North Carolina, and they would pick up mail all along the way. He would sort the mail, throw it off at different locations, and they were, of course, on the train, always crossing, going by these crossing. And several times a year, there would be somebody that would come out on those tracks and boom, train would hit. Train couldn't stop. Train's going along pretty fast. It's got a lot of mass behind it. And it's a big thing. And if it's not possible to stop that train very suddenly. And so these cars would get hit. Ignore warnings like that. We ignore warnings like that at our own peril. I remember my father said he never generally, whenever a car was hit, he never generally got out of the train, although the train would stop there and sometimes it would be sitting there for a couple of hours before everything was taken away and the train could proceed. But he said it was one occasion, it was in December, he got out of the train and walked down to the car that had been hit. And it was a really bad scene. The individual who had been driving the car, he was killed. He was he had his car full of toys for his children. And the train had been hit. It had knocked the door open. He was partially knocked out of the car. I guess maybe he was stunned by the impact, but his head had been banged against the railroad ties as the car was pushed all along the track by the train. It's important to notice the warnings that we're given. On the other hand, I've known people. Actually, we had a really nice dog when I was probably about 6 or 7 years old, maybe about Jackson's age. And it was given to us was a collie. The dog was named Lassie. We named her after the typical name of all collie dogs, Lassie. And we lived near a railroad track. She ran across the railroad tracks one day, and then she heard the train coming. Well, she ran to try and get home, and she tried to cross the railroad tracks and beat the train, and she just almost made it, but the train hit one of her hind legs trailing behind, knocked the hip on that leg out of joint, and for the rest of her life, she walked around with a stiff leg. And so you see that, and people would as well kind of ignore the warnings and try to beat it when they're driving a car. They try to race across sometimes before the train comes. And I remember in the town where we lived, one of the places I lived when we were growing up, somebody tried to do that. They didn't make it across. The train hit the car. The people in the car were not clear of the track. The people in the car weren't severely injured, but the car was destroyed, and it's just not a good thing to try and run and beat the train. warnings. Warnings that we are given. That's one of the things I discovered here. This leaven of the Pharisees is really every time about warning us, and I suppose about leavening of this sort that can be in us, but also about leavening that we have to be aware of from outside sources. So let's take warning and let's beware. It says beware, beware, beware is said over and over, beware, watch out for the leavening of the Pharisees. Well, let's go from there and say, well, what is, if this is something that Christ is telling us to be aware of and to watch out for, we're being warned about it, what is the leaven of the Pharisees? What is the leaven of the Pharisees? This is a big reason, I think, why we don't find peace. And hopefully we are finding peace. And we're working on that. As a congregation, I think we're doing fairly well at it. But this definition that Christ gives about the leaven of the Pharisees is an important reason why there is a difficulty with peace on the face of this earth today. What is the central characteristic of the leavening of the Pharisees? I just had a little interjection in here. Mason and Hazel went to the grocery store. And they were buying some things. They got up to the checkout counter. And Mason is asking Hazel, during these days of unleavened bread, anytime there's any food in question, so on, he's asking her, does this have leavening in it? And so Hazel is always explaining to him whether or not some of his food has leavening in it. Today he was eating at the table and he had his food before anybody else. He probably came around and got some of you to help him get his food. And he was at the table before any of the rest of his family. And so I went over and talked to him and he had a matzo. And I said, that's really good. I see you have this cracker here and it doesn't have any leavening in it. And Mason said, I know. That's the reason I got it. That's very good, Mason. Very good. Leavening of the Pharisees. What's the central characteristic of the leavening of the Pharisees? Luke 12 and verse 1, I think we already read that. But here it is called out very specifically what the central characteristic is of the leavening of the Pharisees. In the meantime, when they were gathered together an innumerable multitude of people, lots of people, everybody all packed together in a crowd, in so much, it says, they trode on one another. I don't know what trode means, but anyway, you get the concept. There are really a lot of them there together in a relatively small space. He began to say to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leavening of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Hypocrisy. And again, you might say, one of the big reasons we don't have very much peace on the face of this earth now is that there is an awful lot of hypocrisy. Whether it's at governmental levels, whether it's in religion, whether it's in business, wherever the institutions are in this country, there is a lot of hypocrisy. And where there is a lot of hypocrisy, there's not going to be a lot of peace. One word definition of the leavening of the Pharisees, Christ said this one word, it is hypocrisy. If you look in Matthew 15 and verse 7, and you can look in any number of places where the leaven of the Pharisees is talked about, or even places where the Pharisees are just talked about, or some of the other religious leaders, and sometimes it's even mentioned in regard to the king in that area, Herod. It's mentioned as the leaven of Herod. But in Matthew 15 and verse 7, and here we get into Christ is discussing with some of the Pharisees hand washing of hands. You hypocrites. He's talking to the Pharisees, and here we just read that the leaven of the Pharisees is hypocrisy, and here he says, you hypocrites. That's quite a denunciation. And you find, maybe I'll talk a little bit about the number of times that the word hypocrite is used in the Gospels as well. You hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you saying, verse 8, because they said he was transgressing the commandments or the traditions of the elders in that he did not do a sufficient amount of washing of his hands. This people draws near to me with their mouth, honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And then he says something that really is something we want to be sure isn't being said about us. In vain, they do worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. It's a warning, isn't it? It's a warning, isn't it? It's a warning to us that we should be strictly observing the laws of God. And this teaching for doctrines, the commandments of men, it's a part of the hypocrisy and the leavening of the Pharisees. Hypocrites. It's the Greek word from which hypocrite derives. It says defined here, the explanation of what it means, it is an actor in a stage play who is putting on a performance. That's what the original Strong's Concordance says. An actor under an assumed character, a dissembler, a hypocrite. I thought in regard to that, hypocrite, stage play, my favorite stage play is Les Miserables, Les Mis, and different characters in that play. And there's one person who really, really in that play pictures this hypocrisy. His name is Thénardier. Thénardier is somebody who has made a small fortune out of robbing the dead. But he runs this inn, and he tries to maintain the specter of being respectable. But you see what it is. He's a real hypocrite. He's a thief who robbed the dead, and behind what's going on in his public presentation of himself, to the people around him, there is this dishonesty and thievery continually going on. Hypocrite, hypocrite. What's hypocritical about the Pharisees? Why does Christ say that they're hypocritical? They profess to be obedient to God, don't they? But really, underneath, they are not. They are hypocritical. And that is just like Thenardier putting on a front for the people to see, but underneath, they're dishonest and dissemblers. That's what it says, the word here it says, dissemblers. 21 times, this name for hypocrite, hypocrites, is used in the New Testament as a noun. Of the 21 times, 17 of them refer to the Pharisees or other religious leaders, or in conjunction with other religious leaders, directly or indirectly, in one way or another. Beware. Beware, it says, watch out for. Look carefully. Don't. This is a warning. Ding, ding, ding. Train's coming. Be careful. Watch out for the leavening of the Pharisees. Beware of hypocrisy. It is the central characteristic of the leavening of the Pharisees. Now, if we see that the central characteristic of the leavening of the Pharisees is hypocrisy, you can say, is there something special about their hypocrisy? You say, leavening of the Pharisees involves hypocrisy, but if you examine it, you find that there is a special kind of hypocrisy, a special attitude having to do with hypocrisy where the Pharisees are concerned. Their hypocrisy encompassed an attitude of accusation. That was one of the main things that distinguished the leavening of the Pharisees from hypocrisy of others. Luke 11 and verse 16. Here in Luke, and in I think both of the other Gospels as well, you find this account. You know, and it's one that we quote at this time of the year, the Pharisees came to him and said, "Show us a sign." Well, the sign that they were talking about was, "Show us the sign that you are the Messiah." But what was their real intent? What was the underlying attitude? Why were they asking for that sign? Others tempting him sought of him a sign from heaven. Perezo, Greek word perezo, means to test, to endeavor, to scrutinize or entice, to prove or to tempt. They came, others tempting him, sought a sign of him from heaven. Verse 53. As he said these things unto them, the scribes and the Pharisees began to urge him vehemently and to provoke him to speak many things, laying wait for him and seeking to catch something out of his mouth that they might accuse him. This leavening of the Pharisees had as central characteristic the desire to accuse. You find that the Pharisees, well, you find that in the Gospels it's recorded that seven times Christ was tested or tempted. First one is in Matthew chapter 4, verse 1. There it says, Christ was led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be perazo, tempted of the devil. It was not just a tempting, it was a tempting for the purpose of accusing. Was attempting for the purpose of accusing. The other six times, all the rest of the occurrences. Once was by Satan the devil. Six times he was tempted or tested by the Pharisees. Now it's recorded throughout the Gospels, you know, sometimes two or three times. It might be recorded in Matthew and Mark. He was tested or tempted. It might be recorded, the same event might be recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where he was tempted or tested for the purposes of accusing him. Six times by the Pharisees. It's recorded. Of course, I have every confidence there were many more times, but what was recorded in the Gospels, six times the Pharisees tested him, it says. Luke chapter 12 and verse 7. Again, beware hypocrisy. The hypocrisy we're talking about is involved with accusation. Beware of it. Watch out. Train coming down the track, we're going to have to deal with this. I would suspect it's at least part of what we're being warned about here as we approach the end of this age. There's going to be this kind of hypocrisy that can end up being very damaging to us. And as you can imagine, there were this kind of hypocrisy, the leaven of the Pharisees, led to the death of Christ. They ultimately killed him. And that had to do with what it was, the leavening of the Pharisees. But what happened to James, Peter, and some of the other apostles? They also encountered this spirit of accusation, and they were put to death because of it. And I have some degree of confidence that I probably don't have to deal with this. But I have also some degree of confidence that some of the rest of you sitting here may have to deal with this ultimately. The leaven of the Pharisees, which will come to accuse and to cause personal destruction and damage to the church and to individuals. They were gathered together, this multitude, and Christ said, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And we could quote it from any of a number of scriptures. So let us take warning. Ding, ding, ding. Here comes the train. But above and beyond the fact that there was an accusation, there's something else very motivational to the Pharisees. You know, there's this methodology, which was accusation, but why were they so intent upon accusing? What motivated them? What was in their heart? Why did they want to make this kind of accusation? There was a particular spirit. There are different kinds of hypocrisy. I already talked about that, you know. There is hypocrisy that we may commit out of weakness. You know, sometimes we just don't want to deal with the situation and we may compromise. That's a kind of hypocrisy, isn't it? We believe one thing, but because of the pressure of the moment, because of what's happening to us, and because of personal weakness, we may make a compromise. That's a kind of hypocrisy. We may see that we may not have the faith to believe that God will do something, and lacking faith, we may commit hypocrisy out of maybe fear. You know, that's people keep bringing up, or it has been brought up any number of times, the Anne Frank House. And if you were hiding Jews in your house and the Gestapo came and knocked on your door and said, "Are you hiding Jews? Are you going to tell the truth or are you going to lie?" And you know you don't believe in lying. But do you have the faith that God can solve that problem? You know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did have that faith. That's tall order, of course. But you could be hypocritical at that moment. You can see how you could be hypocritical at that moment. That's a different kind of hypocrisy than we're talking about with 11 of the Pharisees. 11 of the Pharisees was a particular kind. First of all, it was very accusative. You see, This kind of hypocrisy I'm talking about isn't an accusative kind of hypocrisy. We may fall prey to it, you know, in any kind of way, from situational ethics to whatever. We may fall prey to that. And we have to work on expunging that from our own lives. But the leavening of the Pharisees, it had a motivation. It had a reason for doing it, which satisfied this motivation. Matthew 6 and verse 1. Here's in the Sermon on the Mount, there are several places here where hypocrisy is mentioned. In an instructive way. Matthew 6, it says, "Take heed that you do not do your alms before men to be seen of them. If you do that, you don't have any reward of your Father which is in heaven. Do not sound the trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogue." That was, again, the special kind of hypocrisy. "And in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Truly I say to you, that's all they're getting." You know, people recognize them, see them, and admire them. Wow, aren't they spiritual? What do they want? They're seeking personal aggrandizement. What makes them so accusative? What makes the makeup of their minds so willing to be accusative? Because they have a motivational thing. They seek aggrandizement. They seek glory themselves and recognition from men. And if you look in Matthew 23 and verse 5, all their works do they do to be seen of men. The leavening of the Pharisees. It's hypocrisy. It is accusative. And it is being done, the motivating factor for this kind of hypocrisy is to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries, enlarge the borders of their garments. Enlarge the borders of their garments. I thought, I remember when I was 18, all the girls did that. Who remembers crinoline petticoats? They had these petticoats that they wore underneath. And if you aren't as old as I am, you probably never saw them, don't know what they were, but they wore these underneath to make their skirt very big and full. I don't know how many they would wear. They had numbers, certain numbers of them that they would wear to kind of enlarge the perimeter of their garment. And it wasn't being done for anything nefarious at all. It was just the style of the day. But I thought about it in regard to that. They make broad their phylacteries. I don't know what a phylactery is. I should have looked it up probably. But whatever it is, they were making it broad. I'm sure it has to do with enlarging their ego in some way. Enlarge the borders of their garments. And this made me cringe a little bit. They love the uppermost rooms at the feast and the chief seats in the synagogue. I remember when we all had ministers' rooms, you know, ministers' hospitality rooms. And I understood that there was a need to have ministers have a private place to meet and discuss things. But it was like it was some special perk for the ministry. And I cringe a little bit at that looking back at it now. As far as I know, that's not going on anymore. But it was. And these Pharisees, the leavening of the Pharisees, the motivational factor for them was recognition among people, and they loved to be called rabbi and greeted in the market and recognized in a special way. We don't want to do that. It says, do not be called rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and you are all brethren. So I know that there's a special respect that ought to be extended to the ministry, but I just as soon, personally, I'm not teaching you not to do what the church is teaching you to do, but I just as soon you addressed me by my first name. You know. Just my personal preference. Verse 15. This is what, again, important to the Pharisees to enlarge their phylacteries, enlarge their garments. He says, verse 15, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You compass the sea and land to make one proselyte. When he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. And, I think we have maybe sort of succumbed to that, maybe not for the purpose of aggrandizing, but I remember one time we had a kind of a quota set on the number of baptisms that we wanted to have coming into the church back in the 80s. And it was some sort of a quota. And I just I don't think that's appropriate. And I hear people comparing how many people the Seventh-day Adventists have baptized to the number of people that we've baptized. Not here, but I hear that. You know, I'm talking about this kind of leavening that we can sort of get into ourselves. So we want to take warning. We don't want to get involved in that. And I'm not saying that we are. But what you see being described here, I used to live in a house in a small town in Georgia, and between my house and the village where there was shopping and so forth that we did, there was a junkyard. And if we're going to talk about the sheep and the goats, in the junkyard, there was a herd of goats. And the herd of goats loved to get on top of the car. They'd pick a car. One of them would get on top of the car, and he would start lording it on the others. And then they would come charging up the car and try to butt him off, and they would play king on the car, I guess you'd say, or king on the hill. And that's kind of, you know, say, aggrandizing attitude that the Pharisees had. They wanted to be recognized for everything that they had. Beware. Beware. Take warning that we don't do anything to adopt that kind of an attitude. You see, you had that's a big characteristic of the leavening of the Pharisees. They wanted to accuse. And the purpose of their accusing was so that they could aggrandize themselves. They could elevate themselves. You might say that oftentimes they wanted to push somebody else down so that they could be brought up. That's how some people elevate themselves, how some people gain recognition in a comparative way by putting other people down. The next characteristic that I noticed that Christ really condemned on the part of the Pharisees was a lack of proportionality. Lack of proportionality. Kind of blindness. Kind of blindness that involved, we might say, measuring in the minors. They didn't just have the aptitude or the ability or the vision. They had a blindness. They didn't have the vision to recognize what was important and what was not important. And maybe they didn't have that vision because it didn't suit their purposes. It didn't fulfill the motivations that they had in being recognized themselves and having this sort of adulation of the people. Luke 11 and verse 42. Luke 11 verse 42. Woe unto you, Pharisees! Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. You tithe mint, it says in rue. I know the scripture in Matthew 23, I think it is, says you tithe mint, anise, and cumin. Here in Luke it says you tithe mint and rue. I'm not sure what rue is. If anybody knows what rue is, tell me. Not now, but later. Some sort of a herb, I guess. You tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs. But yet, you pass over judgment and the love of God. It's part of the leaven of the Pharisees. You should be tithing, he said, even on these little things. But there's a proportionality here. You can't leave the big matters out and take care of the little matters. And one of the main reasons they were taking care of the little matters is you would infer they were taking care of the little matters because the people could see how righteous they were in taking care of those little matters. Tithing on mint, tithing on anise, tithing on cumin, tithing on rue, and all manner of herbs. This undoubtedly created a recognition, but they neglected other things. Combined with an accusative spirit, I suppose, and it matches up with a desire to put somebody else down so you can elevate yourself. I could just see myself falling into this sort of condemnation or accusation when I go to the meat counter in Tartu. You're sitting, go to the meat counter, and for a long time they hardly had any beef at all. Now they have beef. I mean, it's a really big upgrade in Tartu. Quite a bit of beef on the counter. And almost always now, they have chopped beef sitting there, a big bowl of chopped beef sitting there in the counter. Just to the other side of that bowl of chopped beef, there's a bowl of chopped pork. And they have one spoon. And if you want to buy beef, they pick the spoon up, and they dish some of the beef out into a bag and weigh it and give it to you. But then after you've gotten that, they put the spoon right back between the two bowls. Somebody else comes along and they dip the pork out of the bowl with the same spoon. Now, I suppose in conjunction with 11 of the Pharisees, that somebody could say, look at him. He bought that beef and that spoon has been in the pork, and he says he believes in keeping the laws of clean and unclean meats, but if he did, he wouldn't be buying that beef there. I just think this is an example. Okay, I ought to be tithing on the mint, the anise, and the cumin. I should never get involved in anything where I might get some amount of grease or something off of that spoon into the beef that I bought. But on the other hand, I could go hungry a long time in Estonia. And I'm looking at the sense of proportionality there. See, that's one of the big characteristics of the leaven of the Pharisees here: lack of a sense of proportionality. They didn't have that sense of proportionality. They would be very accusative. They had an accusative spirit over that. Now, I didn't want to bring this. I want to address something I think needs to be addressed. I didn't intend to address it necessarily in regard to this sermon, and I'm certainly not trying to call anybody a Pharisee because I don't think anybody is. But there's a lack of proportionality, I think, in the situation in Chile, having to do with the Sabbath. You know, there was a family there that owned a daycare center. And for 4 days, and one of the reasons I'm addressing this is because I think there are a number of people who don't understand the lack of the circumstances there and how this is a matter of a little bit of proportionality. And some people have said that we're doing away with the Sabbath day over this matter. But this family, this one little family, owned this daycare center, and they always closed it in time for the Sabbath until the government passed a law. The government passed a law that they had to keep it open to a certain time or they couldn't be in business as a daycare center. Well, they went home themselves, stopped working, only allowed people to come and somebody stayed there till people could come and pick up their children at the end of the day. And this only went past the Sabbath for 4 weeks out of the year. Four Fridays out of the year. 4 Friday evenings out of the year. And now, I'm not saying that they should do that, but I'm also saying that because that wasn't dealt with speedily, and I think it has been ruled since then, that this is not equivalent to saying that we're doing away with the Sabbath. There's a lack of proportionality in saying that. And so that proportionality is something that we need to maintain. We need, like I say, I don't need to eat that. I don't, maybe I shouldn't eat the pork that was dished out of there with a spoon that had a little bit of grease on it. Maybe I shouldn't. Probably I shouldn't. But it doesn't mean I've done away with the laws of clean and unclean meats. You know, and I'm not practicing them. You know, it'd be sort of like there was one person who used to come down 20, 30 years ago now, and he was an older person, and you know, we'd taught the laws of clean and unclean meats, and in the mornings he had some sausage. I don't know if it's Jimmy Dean's pure pork or what it was. We had these little sausages, and he was telling people in the congregation he'd had them, and everybody was saying, "Well, you shouldn't be eating those sausages." And he said, "Well, they're only little ones, you know." But it would be like somebody doing that, accusing me because of the spoon. There's that kind of hypocrisy when they're doing a lot more. The Pharisees were doing a lot more things than they were accusing the others of. The contrast is the weightier matters of the law. You know, this lack of proportionality on one hand, but on the other hand, there were the weightier matters of the law. Matthew 23 and verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You pay tithes of the mint, anise, and cumin, and omitted the weightier matters of the law, which are... What are the three weightier matters of the law? Judgment, mercy, and faith. These you ought to have done. In other words, we ought to keep every bit of the laws of clean and unclean meats. We ought to keep every bit of the laws of the Sabbath. We ought to keep every bit of the laws of God. But the hypocrisy, the accusing hypocrisy on the part of the Pharisees was to the omission of judgment, mercy, and faith. He said, "You blind guides which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel." You see, they accused, as I said, Christ and they ended up killing him. They set these traps of accusation against Christ, and they end up crucifying him for, among other things, breaking the Sabbath day because he healed people on the Sabbath day. Wasn't a breaking of the Sabbath day at all anyway, was it? It was absolutely not breaking the Sabbath day to heal somebody because the Sabbath day is of all times the most relevant and the most important time when somebody could and should be healed. Sabbath day pictures what? Pictures the coming of the kingdom of God. When is the time of great healing for mankind here on the face of the earth, spiritually as well as physically? It's the kingdom of God, which is pictured by the Sabbath day. And when Christ healed those people on the Sabbath day, he was fulfilling the Sabbath day. And they killed, and they wanted to accuse him for doing it. And a lack of, absolute lack of proportionality, and a lack of judgment, mercy, and faith. Straining at a gnat, swallowing a camel. As I said, you know, James was killed by some of the same people. He was thrown off of the temple. Peter was apparently crucified upside down by some of those people. Paul was arrested in Jerusalem by some of those people and ultimately taken back to Rome, put in prison, and he had his head lopped off. The leavening of the Pharisees. We have to watch out for it. We have to watch out for it in ourselves. We have to. I think we'll probably have to watch out for it from the outside ultimately. I think that may be a good part of the warning that we are receiving. Watch out for the leavening. Beware. Beware the leavening of the Pharisees. There is a certain amount of leavening. And during the days of unleavened bread, we don't want to tolerate any leavening, do we? But it's impossible really to eliminate all of the leavening. It just, we do the best we can, and we're doing a physical thing, but we don't get all of the leavening. We don't get all of the leavening. It's in the air. It floats around in the air. And when you have something, it starts to light on that and starts to grow. That's how the Israelites were able to reproduce leavening year after year. You take all the leavening, get it out, get rid of it, no leavening left. But then, after the days of unleavened bread, how did they accumulate yeast again so that they would be able to make bread for the coming year? They put out a ball of dough. And the yeast from the air would start to grow on that ball of dough. And then they would have, in a short while, it grows exponentially, you know, in a short while, they would have, again, the must that they needed to be able to make bread. There is, however, a certain amount of yeast that we can tolerate. There's a certain amount of yeast that we can tolerate, and we don't want to have too much. It's as I said last week in last Sabbath in Buffalo, there's a dose response, toxicology and a dose response. You know, a certain amount we can tolerate, but too much is really not a good thing. And any, of course, is not a good thing. But we have to live with some, but we really have to keep it out as much as we can. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 9, one of the places where the idea of leavening is talked about. Paul writes to the church in Galatia, He said, after I've taught you what's happened, how did this come in? How did it spread throughout the congregation here? He's talking about certain doctrinal things. He says, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. It's dose responsive, I guess, but it doesn't take a very big dose. That's what he's saying. You can take a ball of dough, and only a little bit of leavening in that will start to eliminate the attitude of encouragement that we have, the attitude of peace that we should have, and the attitude of joy, which we want to maintain among ourselves and toward each other. A little bit of leaven leavens the whole lump. We are to root out the leaven of the Pharisees from our own lives. We are to take warning as well. There will be leavening. Beware. Beware. There's going to be leavening which will not be under our control. There was leavening which wasn't under the control of Christ. There was leavening that wasn't under the control of James. There was leavening that Peter couldn't have control over, and Paul couldn't have control over, and who knows how many of the other disciples. There will be leaven. So beware of the leaven of the Pharisees in your own life and as it may affect you from outside. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Leviticus 26 and verse 6. We have this assurance. If we ourselves deal with our own leavening, God says from the sermonette, I will give peace.